This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Practical for Your Practice. I am Dr. Kevin Holloway, one of your hosts, and I'm joined today by my fabulous co-host, Dr. Jenna Ermold.
Thank you, Kevin. I needed to be called fabulous today.
You are
fabulous.
It's
been a day, so you know I'm gonna put that on a loop and just play it over and over.
It's recorded.
Yeah, good.
It'll mess up our listener count, but that's okay.
It will.
Make us feel well, good.
That would make me feel more fabulous.
Right, absolutely. We have another listener question. Jenna, can you believe that?
I am loving that these are starting to roll in. It's very excited. So what is it? I'm dying to
Okay, here we go. So I'm going to read this one here. It says, you all keep hammering getting consultation. We do. Guilty as charged. Yeah. But I don't even know how to go about finding an EBP consultant. What do I do? And it's signed Teresa from Burlington. And I'm not sure which state, but Burlington somewhere.
I'm guessing Vermont, because that's where my alma mater, UVM. Yay.
Absolutely. So.
So it's a great question. And you're right. We hammer it all the time. There's many different ideas that I have on this front. The first one I'm going to say is there are like training places like us, Center for Deployment Psychology, that offers free consultation. So like if you take one of our evidence-based psychotherapy workshops, like prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, suicide prevention, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, we have consultation comes with that. So you are invited to a weekly consultation group. In fact, the person that we're going to talk to today is one of our folks that came to consultation, and we've gone from consultation to colleagues, and it's so cool. Right. What other ideas, Kevin?
Well, you know, it occurs to me that in a lot of places where people work, it could be in a hospital setting or a clinic or a group practice, there may be some of your colleagues who have some expertise in any of these EVPs. So find out, like, who are you working with and what expertise do they have, and see if they're willing to do consultation with you. Consultation doesn't have to be formal or, you know, official, so to speak.
Or expensive.
Yeah, or expensive. Sometimes there are consultants that do consultation for a fee. So another way is to look through, you know, any of the provider indexes that maybe, you know, you might be listed on, or that you may be looking for, you know, a referral. And a lot of those folks will also indicate that they do consultation for a fee in a particular EVP. So consider that as another possibility. Talk amongst your colleagues. And also look on those provider indexes and see who's available. What are they offering?
And I'll throw out National Center for PTSD has a consultation line that's a service and, you know, consultation line that's fantastic. I think StrongStar, which is another group that we collaborate with. So reach out to us if you have questions, see if we can help guide you. But really, really glad you're looking into it.
That sounds like good information to put in the show notes.
For sure.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool. So check those out if you're curious about some of the organizations we mentioned too. All right. I'm excited because we have a fabulous guest today, Jenna.
We do.
And
she's
so
one of my favorites.
Yes. And like Jenna said, she's been coming to our PE consultation group for a while. And of course, even before that, I met her in a research program a couple years even before that. So this is a good, long, well-established relationship. We're excited to have her on, Dr. Robin Brody. So welcome, Robin.
Thank you. Yeah, you just can't get rid of me, can you?
No, and I'm glad. I mean,
get rid of you. We keep trying to pull you in tighter and tighter and tighter, right. And you're resisting, Robin.
We'll I like to be heard today.
You know, that's what it feels like. But
well, it's great to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
We're so happy to have you. Can you just introduce yourself briefly? Tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Dr. Robin Brody. I am a psychologist. I am currently in private practice. I think we were also going to talk a little bit about how I got here, and my path has been winding. But I I specialize in the treatment of PTSD as well as work with gender and sexual minorities. And I do a bit of couples work as well. And but PTSD is really my bread and butter and where my heart is. So glad to get to talk to you more.
We're happy to have you. Like, well, people who have listened to the show before know that Jenna and I are also very much, passionate about PTSD and PTSD treatment. We're both prolonged exposure therapy trainers and consultants. So, like, we're right there with you. How'd you get into that?
By accident, honestly. And I say that because I often work with trainees who are like, wow, you have such a clear, career path. And I kind of laugh because, truly when I started grad school, I was interested in doing eating disorder work. I do exactly zero eating disorder work and have done zero eating disorder work since about my first semester of grad school. I did a lot of substance use research and clinical work in grad school and working with in a clinic for gender and sexual minority folks. And what I just kind of kept finding was like we were talking about the presenting problem, but underneath what was there was untreated trauma. And led me to get training in a VA setting where I was initially exposed to cognitive processing therapy and PE and really fell in love with both of those treatments and in working with veterans. And then did my internship at a VA in the Bronx. And again, focused a lot on PE, CPT. And then the pandemic happened while I was on internship. And like kind of what better event to happen when you're focused on PTSD treatment, a global pandemic. And I was living in New York in the epicenter of it all. So my postdoc was where Kevin we met, and I was working at Cornell in the program for anxiety and traumatic stress studies, and was getting to do kind of a combination of clinical work as well as research, as well as being a clinician on various research studies, which is a fantastic way to learn an EBP
Absolutely.
and get consultation as well. So got to kind of expand my population and work a lot with healthcare workers. Both through that program and through an employee assistance program. And then most recently, I was working in a clinic serving 9/11 responders. So have gotten to do this work and, Venn diagram overlapping populations for sure. But it's been really, really a pleasure to get to work with these various populations and also train others in these treatments, which has been very rewarding.
I have, I have valued your contributions and consultation greatly, but I love your varied background. I mean, you've had a lot of different, you've done PTSD work and with, lots of different populations when it comes down to it. And you've always brought some really interesting case examples and presentations. And then I feel like I've learned more from you than you've probably learned from me as a consultant, but I love that about you. And today, we didn't really kind of talk about what our topic was going to be, but our topic today is going to be on it's traumatic invalidation, PTSD, and suicide risk, and all of that sort of winding background, which we've all acknowledged. I think Kevin, Corinne, and I, all of the hosts, have had incredibly, kind of winding paths. But kind of relate to your passion for that work as well. And maybe before we even start talking about your experience with that and thoughts about that, for our listeners who don't know what that is, can we sort of define what is traumatic invalidation? What is that concept? And maybe how does that fit in with this sort of maintenance or development of PTSD?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a concept that I was not exposed to in a lot of my training, and it wasn't until the last couple of years that I really came to understand it more fully. I think those who have any sort of DBT background tend to have some understanding of it, as it's one of the kind of components of Marsha Linehan's biosocial theory of suicidality and BPD. But when we talk about traumatic invalidation, what we're really talking about is when the person's environment either repeatedly or very intensely communicates that their either characteristics, who they are, their behaviors, their emotional reactions, that those are unacceptable. And typically traumatic invalidation occurs or is done by important people. So this could be family members, bosses, or groups or institutions. So it can kind of happen on the micro level of one's home, as well as the societal level through things like systemic racism, can be described through a traumatic invalidation lens. And importantly, it kind of leads to one's beliefs about themselves and kind of how one fits in the world changing. And so traumatic invalidation can take a lot of forms. It can look like severe criticism. It can look like emotional neglect. It can look like unequal treatment or excluding or blaming or denying reality. So there's a lot of different ways that this can show up. And in terms of how it relates to PTSD, I recall doing a training with Melanie Harned on traumatic invalidation. And I recall very vividly this moment where she just very bluntly said, like, traumatic invalidation can and does result in PTSD. And as someone who's been, very kind of a staunch supporter of let's not call everything trauma.
Right.
I frankly really bristled at this at first. And then through my experience, I think one of the most humbling things has been doing more work around traumatic invalidation with folks, say, like 9/11 responders. And when we kind of sit down and we try and identify an index trauma to do CPT with or PE with, I am continuously amazed by the frequency with which a traumatic invalidation related instance that might not be considered meeting criteria for criterion A, that is actually the index trauma that is most distressing, most haunting, most impactful at this point in their life.
And becomes the focus of therapy.
Often.
So let me see if I understand this. And I think when I've heard you speak about this before, I might've asked a similar question, so I apologize, but just for our learners or our listeners' benefit, the traumatic invalidation, it sounds like maybe there's kind of two possible components here too. On the one hand, we're talking about situations or circumstances that while sometimes may not sound like a criterion A as it's currently defined in the DSM, they set up a situation where that in itself is the trauma that people are responding to. And I'm thinking of things like emotional abuse, right? Like that if you go strictly by the DSM, you'd have a hard time necessarily fitting it into that box of a criterion A, but certainly could fit as we're talking about traumatic invalidation and just one form of that. Or, you know, kind of the disreception that happened to Vietnam veterans as they returned from war, you know, those kind of situations where, again, not necessarily fitting criterion A, but absolutely could be the basis for these dysfunctional responses that very much are PTSD in every other way. But it also sounds like there's this invalidation after another kind of trauma too, right? Like the sexual assault survivor who's not believed or told it was their fault or it's all in their head or, you know, whatever that else that might be. So I'm hearing kind of two pieces of that. I wondered if you would comment on that.
Yeah, no, I think the both of the examples of the sexual assault survivor and the Vietnam veteran returning are, you know, really classic examples of when there is an index event that meets criterion A, and then there is invalidation from the environment. It's your fault or being called a baby killer or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
Criticism. And I'm sure anyone who's worked with PTSD knows that oftentimes it's actually that response that can be more harmful.
Right.
And that is that's the traumatic invalidation component. So certainly it can happen where there is an index event. I've also worked with people where maybe they've had index events, maybe they haven't, but the extent or severity of the invalidation has been the thing that has really changed the trajectory of their life. And right, if we kind of how I think about it is like traumatic invalidation communicates in some way that you are unacceptable, whether that is who you are, what you are doing, how you are feeling, what you're feeling, how you're expressing those feelings. Like, you are not acceptable, right? And so when that happens so intensely, it does threaten one's humanity, personhood, right? In a similar way that in Criterion A event would.
Yeah.
And so then when, you know, a trauma cue comes up, maybe it doesn't cue, say, a belief of the world is dangerous, though it might, but it can cue this belief of like, I don't belong, I cause problems, I'm crazy, I can't trust myself, I don't matter. And when they hit like that close to those shame-related beliefs, and like sense of who one is, it, to me, it just kind of makes logical sense then, both the connection to suicide, but also the connection to PTSD. And so many of my patients go, you know, above and beyond in the same way that they would, you know, engaging in safety behaviors to prevent, say, a fire, right? To prevent situations where they are going to be invalidated. And maybe that looks like not speaking up. Maybe that looks like not trusting themselves.
Yeah.
Maybe it looks like acting as though they are inferior. So that was a very long-winded answer for you.
No, that's great.
No, it was great. And actually appreciated even Kevin, some of the examples that you gave, because I think that helps to really, you know, shed light on what this looks like, you know, clinically in your office. You mentioned suicidality. You know, so I know it may seem kind of obvious, but, you know, what is that relationship then with traumatic invalidation and suicidality? What do we need to look out for? How can providers kind of be more aware of that and work with that more effectively, perhaps?
Yeah, great. I really appreciate that question. I mean, so kind of going back to some of what Marcia Linehan wrote is, we know that when one's environment is invalidating, that is part of the component which can lead to chronic suicidality, right? The other part being emotion dysregulation. And, right, we see a lot of that with folks with PTSD. It's a closely overlapping Venn diagram often. And, you know, a traumatic invalidation instance can be the kind of the trauma cue. It can be the thing that in that instance goes on to trigger the suicide. It can be kind of that same like activation of a, if you will, like a stuck point in CPT terms that comes up. And you know, what we know from the literature is traumatic invalidation increases the severity and incidence of both PTSD and suicidality. And it's likely showing up whether or not it's being talked about. And and we can, again, similarly, Kevin, to what you were saying earlier, there's a lot of traumatic invalidation around suicide as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
How could you possibly think that that was going to solve your problems, right? Or so selfish,
yeah.
Right? Completely invalidating the excruciating pain that one has to be in,
yeah,
the manageability one has to feel to consider death as a viable option.
So just for our listeners' benefit, you've mentioned Marcia Linehan, developer of dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, that we said earlier, but also BPD, borderline personality disorder. And so dialectical behavior therapy is, like, I think still, correct me if I'm wrong, Robin, one of the only therapies that had demonstrated any efficacy with borderline personality disorder folks. And then you also mentioned Melanie Harned, who has developed kind of a combination DBT-PE protocol. In fact, dbtpe.org. So a lot of connections here, right? Between a lot of the major players and the pieces that we're talking about. So, I mean, and maybe I already answered the question, but love to hear your answer. You know, when I mentioned dbtpe, but what do we do with this?
Yeah.
Like, you know, when we've got a client in the room who, you know, not only have they experienced a trauma, or their trauma is traumatic invalidation, or that's an additional layer on top of that. And, you know, that we maybe have the impact on suicidality. Like, How do we approach this? Is this standard PTSD evidence-based psychotherapies? Is this adding on additional things concurrently at the same time? Do we treat them in a particular order? Like, how do you approach this?
Yeah, and I'm glad you kind of brought back in Dr. Harned here, because it's been a really, I think probably one of the learning DBT PE has changed how I practice so fundamentally, both with PTSD and other, frankly. But yeah, it kind of, there is this question, and certainly in my training when I was learning these treatments, there was no consideration of me implementing CPT or PE with someone who's experiencing current suicidality, current suicidal crises, right? That's typically very not considered a great idea, right? And so there's been this, I think the field has, frankly, kind of systematically undertreated those who probably need this treatment more
The
than
most.
anyone else. And there hasn't really been a framework of, okay, so when do we start, Kevin, to your question, when do we start the EPP for PTSD? What do we need kind of in place in terms of safety? And I was trained kind of from a stage-based model of trauma recovery. And so it was a lot on stabilization. And then I joined a clinical research program where it was like, okay, you meet this patient and go, you're doing, tons of PE, right? So I've kind of been on both sides, and the best PTSD treatment in the world is going to be ineffective if the person is dead or hospitalized. So we do need to do everything we can to ensure that is the case. And there is inherent risk in not treating PTSD, right? We know that untreated PTSD increases suicide risk. And so the kind of the framework that Melanie Harned and her colleagues developed is like I think a very helpful set of criteria that you kind of ask yourself along with the patient, are these met? And when they are met, we can treat the PTSD. And these are things like no imminent risk of suicidality. Right? That doesn't mean in weeks or months, that means imminent. Right. And it's also talks about self-directed violence, right? We don't want that to be kind of the go-to coping mechanism because trauma processing therapies inherently activate painful emotions, painful memories. And part of the goal of them is to help the patient learn that they can handle them. But if they can't actually handle them, right, we're setting them up for failure. So much of the kind of the readiness criteria is around, do they have the skills that they need to cope effectively with the intense emotions that arise? Can they have those without suicide being the solution for them? And then I think a lot of the other criteria are just helpful in general to consider when doing an EBP for PTSD, right? Like, is there any serious therapy interfering behavior? I'm sure I know I have, I'm sure you have worked with people where there is. And
Can we have some examples of that? Like, what do you mean by
sure.
trauma or therapy interfering behaviors?
Therapy interfering behaviors could look like yelling at the therapist to the point where the therapist can't speak, right? Hard for me to be helpful in that situation. It can look like not doing your homework, right? Not bringing in your homework when we know that that is a critical part of ensuring that someone gets the correct dose of treatment. It could look like they don't have childcare and they have a 2-year-old, and we don't want to traumatize the 2-year-old by having them hear mommy's trauma.
And seeing mommy all dysregulated as well, right?
Totally, totally.
And we're not just talking about standard avoidance kind of behaviors we would often see with anybody with PTSD, but this is like kind of going beyond.
Yeah, so it can be avoidance as well, right? Like frequently missing sessions, it's really hard to do treatment. And or anything in the therapeutic alliance, not like a lack of shared understanding of what the problem is, can be therapy interfering. It can also make it so that PTSD is not the top priority for the person to treat, which is another one of the criteria, right? If someone thinks, the thing that is making my life unmanageable at this point is, you know, my insomnia. That's maybe not the best example because that could also be helped with treating PTSD. But if it's, you know, something else entirely, right, and you're going in on PTSD, 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 not only is that going to invalidate what they feel is most important, but probably it's not going to be as successful of a course of treatment. Another important one is like, can this person and is this person willing to experience intense emotions without escaping, right? And this is important regardless of the type of trauma processing treatment you're doing, where so much of the point of it and the mechanisms of action involve having those emotions arise, learning that they can tolerate them, and like whether it be habituation occurring or kind of the natural resolve of primary emotions, right? They need to be able to feel them without escaping that. Mm-hmm. And so that's one that I will really test out with patients. Maybe it, if someone's finds sadness absolutely intolerable, right? Maybe it's giving them homework or in session, watching a clip of something sad, like puppies being, I don't know, right?
So even a little bit of exposure just to emotion and
correct
experiencing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I found really helpful in having like a clear cut kind of framework for deciding when to start an EBP for PTSD is to share that with the patient. And I will sit down with them with this handout that comes from the DBTPE manual, and we'll look at it together and say, where are we, right? Mm-hmm. I believe that a lot of your issues are being caused by the activation of PTSD. So we need to treat this to get you to where you want to go. And to treat this, we need to address these things. And I have been amazed by how quickly some things can shift when that is the contingency in place.
Interesting. So when you set it up as, I know that if we can do this treatment, it's going to be effective and you're going to take back all this territory and, you know, have a reduction in distress. But to get there, we've got these skills deficits. We've got some, you know, sort of emotion regulation stuff we need to work on. So if, do you find that that then like really increase, so that increases motivation to be able to build those skills, to be able to then move more successfully into the PTSD treatment? And that's sort of what the DBTPE does. So like when you identify, yep, we're not ready for the EBP, what do you do to kind of get them moving forward then? Is it that protocol?
I think it's addressing whatever it is that's making them not meet those criteria. And so DBTPE itself is meant to go alongside a typical DBT course of treatment. So someone might be, if you're doing full model DBTPE, they would be in skills group. Mm-hmm. Part of the DBTPE protocol is having a part of the session be just DBT focused. So you're going to be reviewing diary card, you're going to be doing chain analyses, you're going to be doing all of the straight up DBT interventions. Mm-hmm. And then there's a part of the session that is the PE session. And there are some definite meaningful changes that were made to the PE part of DBTPE. And as someone who had done a lot of PE beforehand, it was really a pretty seamless transition to doing the PE part of DBTPE. I don't know if I fully answered the question that you posed.
Robin, one of the things that we talked about prior is our theme this season is who's got your six. And as you talk about working with folks, with all of these things on board, and I know from some of the clients that you've worked with how incredibly tough the work you do is, how rewarding it is, how talented and skilled you are, but you know, kind of hearing over and over again about traumatic invalidation and you know what's going on in the world, and you know, being with people who are highly distressed, it can take its toll, right? It's a hard thing to do. So it's a passion for you, but it's hard. So as I mentioned, our theme is who's got your six. We kind of want to hope our listeners really focus for themselves through stories from our guests on like how do you make sure that your back's covered and that you feel like you're getting support. We ask you not to name names because then people you don't name might get mad, but you're like, who's got your six? That can be personal, it can be professional. But how has that played out for you?
Yeah, I really love the theme of this season. I think doing this work, and certainly a part of DBT, is having a consultation team. And whether that's a formal DBT consultation team or not, having a team of colleagues who are kind of in the trenches as well, who I can say, hey, I'm like having a really hard time being effective with this patient. I just like, they are shaping me out of what's effective behavior, or, you know, I'm having a lot of anxiety about this person. And like, can you look over my documentation? That has been hugely, hugely critical for me to be able to sleep at night, frankly. And I think like relatedly, I have been very fortunate to, in all of the places I have trained and worked, collected some phenomenal colleagues. And, you know, there are several people who, after a particularly rough session, you know, we're all across the country at this point, but we'll text them and say like, woof. And they'll be like, I'm calling you at four. I'm done that time. And to have those people just to, so I don't have to hold it all on my own. Certainly consultation, learning new treatments, learning new things. There's some literature around that as being very effective for preventing burnout. I think maybe where I'm getting with all of this is like, we know social support is a really important predictor of resilience when it comes to trauma exposure. And so that's kind of, I would say that's a big part of it for me, as well as people in my life who are not psychologists, do not have any idea what I do, and like, frankly, are not that interested in hearing it in detail, because that's also really important for me to be able to put it on a shelf when I leave and go, you know, do the things that make me a whole human outside of just a psychologist.
That's such a great way of reinforcing that we need the woof people in our life, right? The ones that just get it. They do what we do. They know exactly kind of where we are and what's going to be helpful. And then we need the people who are completely oblivious to sort of the ins and outs, but that really round out who we are as humans and the kinds of pleasurable and wonderful things we get to do in life and have conversations that have absolutely nothing to do with trauma and distress and all the things. So that's fantastic, Robin.
Jenna's one of my woof people, so I appreciated woof. That.
Woof.
I wasn't sure if that's a shrinking reference.
I'm pretty sure, right? Yes.
No? I don't know, actually. It might be. I didn't.
He does say that. And anyway, it's a great, now I'm going to take that on. And you know that I'm Kevin, you're going to be getting some woof messages.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, you happen to also be on the receiving end.
Excellent.
Yes. So, I mean, really, really love the, I mean, we could go on for hours and hours and talk about this. This is such a really rich and fertile area to talk about. But I mean, as we're thinking about just what we've talked about today, we like to end all of our episodes with a discussion about actionable intel. The idea that, you know, listeners can take away a couple of things that they can implement right now, you know, some suggestions for what they can do to impact their practice currently or the work that they do currently. So you have a couple of ideas for us, a couple of thoughts about actionable intel that our listeners can take with them.
Incoming actionable intel.
Yeah, I do. Kevin, you mentioned the dbtpe.org website.
Mm-hmm.
I will reinforce that. And there's really helpful kind of like hour and a half long trainings on there. I think one of my actionable intel items is in the DBTPE manual. You do not need to do the whole treatment. There are two handouts on traumatic invalidation that describe what it is. And then the second one describes the impact of it. And I use those handouts probably with like 80 to 90% of my patients, regardless of if they're DBT PE patients, because I have found it to be such a profoundly impactful intervention to name the traumatic invalidation and give people an understanding of, oh, this is real. Like the response I often get is like, it feels like someone was reading my diary when they see kind of that description. So really powerful psychoeducation tool. I think the other actionable item is for folks doing PTSD, EBPs, to at least assess for potential traumatic invalidation. That can be done through psychoeducation, sharing one of these handouts, having a conversation. It can also be through, screening measures like the Invalidating Childhood Environment Scale or the Everyday Discrimination Scale are two good ones. There are also some that are specifically oriented towards traditionally marginalized groups. Experiences of heterosexism or experiences of racism that are great starting points to not further invalidate by ignoring the potential invalidation that's there.
Really appreciate that. And all of those resources you mentioned, we'll put in the show notes so that folks that are listening can go find those links and references there. So really, really appreciate the conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely. As you said, it can go for hours.
Right. Well, like you said, I think it's something that we probably don't consider as often as we should. Like I know for myself, I think when I first was introduced the concept, it was kind of like, well, yeah, like all traumas have invalidating parts of them. I'm like, well, that's kind of the point, right? Let's not contribute more to that, but also, you know, assess for how that's contributing and what part it plays.
It's nice to just also be reminded of the power, you know, the psychoeducation piece, just the power of validating invalidation, right? Like that, that just is such an important thing that we need to remember to do. So I appreciate those recommendations. I can't wait to look at some of those resources.
Same, yeah.
And I think the other thought that I'm just having is like, I think we miss out on a lot of potential focus of treatment and also potential benefit from treatment when we don't treat the invalidation. And I'm thinking of patients for whom like, okay, we've reduced the avoidance of the, you know, the things that remind them of the combat trauma, right? But they're still walking through this world existing as if they are in fact invalid, right? And so they are not doing anything to disprove that unhelpful belief that they are untrustworthy or to blame, right? And so it's like, if we can get this person testing some of that out through exposure, for example, or through cognitive restructuring, like, boy, oh boy, like their life could, there's still so much more their life could improve. So it's been truly doing this work has been the most rewarding thing in the universe. So,
and such fantastic work, like really honestly appreciate you being here and talking to us about this. This is so, it's enlightening. It makes me think of so many other, areas or I don't know, ways that this shows up for clients too. So I think, for now, that's the time that we have, but appreciate you coming on. Always good to see you. We hope to continue to see you in our consultation group.
As I said, it's hard to get rid of me.
That's right.
We can't quit you, Robin. We just can't quit you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Like, appreciate you tuning in and listening as well. Of course, more episodes coming up this season. But until then, stay curious.
And mind your EBPs.
Remember, we love hearing from our listeners, so leave us a message on SpeakPipe or send us an email. Both can be found in our show notes. Our theme music is Failed Attempts by Nitro, and our administrative assistant is Bree Mercer.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
If you like what you're hearing, please feel free to follow us, rate this episode, and share it with others.
Until next time.